Welcome to a Juno Afternoon on Monday, April 6, 2015. I'm your host, Scott Burton. On today's show, we'll talk to Maude Morse about buying a house in Alaska. We'll get a preview of upcoming community emergency response training workshops. Kathy DiLorenzo and Tom Chard will be here to highlight a free lecture on Medicaid expansion and reform. And we'll talk with John Hatton about the world of folk music. Those interviews, National Native News, Writer's Almanac, Bird Note, music, and more right here on a Juno Afternoon.
For National Native News, I'm Tristan Ottone, sitting in for Antonia Gonzalez. Sexual assault survivors and tribal agencies that advocate on their behalf gathered at the state capitol in Oklahoma City last week to share their stories of sexual violence in Indian country. KGOU's Jacob McClellan reports advocates sought the attention of state legislators because many Native women are victimized in state jurisdiction.
The Violence Against Women Act is slowly being implemented in Indian country. Kevin Washburn is the Assistant Secretary of Indian Affairs at the Department of the Interior. He's taking part in a conference in Rapid City on the new act. Washburn says many tribes are now in the early stages of enforcing this new law.
What we have found over time is that the more authority tribes have to take care of their communities, the better those communities are taken care of. When we can empower tribes, they do a great job.
Each tribe has the option of keeping the status quo or taking on the new authority. Carmen O'Leary is director for the Native Women's Society of the Great Plains. She says many tribes are exercising their sovereignty.
I think that tribal leaders, they do want to protect the welfare of their people, and so this is just one more tool in the toolbox, and I know as they can, they will be implementing it.
The Crow Creek Sioux tribe is among those taking on this new jurisdiction. Tribal chairwoman Roxanne Sazu says the effort to end violence against women is not something tribes have to do all on their own.
We need to work together, the tribes along with the state, in order to ensure the safety of Native women and all women.
While the act is being implemented in many tribal nations, officials point out that hurdles remain. They include a lack of resources and funding for tribal law enforcement. I'm Charles Michael Ray in Rapid City, South Dakota.
Industrial hemp farming may be returning to the Pine Ridge Reservation. In 1998, the Oglala Sioux tribe legalized hemp with a requirement that the plants have low level of THC, the active compound found in marijuana. But when Oglala Sioux tribal member Alex Whiteplume planted hemp on his land, it was raided by DEA agents. Charles Michael Ray reports, now that the federal government is loosening restrictions on tribes who want to grow marijuana, Whiteplume is eager to start planting again.
Right now, Alex Whiteplume faces a restraining order keeping him from planting industrial hemp on his Pine Ridge farm. That order came as part of a court settlement following DEA raids of his hemp crop between 2000 and 2002.
We didn't want to go to jail, so we never collected any seeds. We just stood idly by and watched the seeds fall on the ground, and so we're just starting fresh with zero seeds.
Whiteplume says his attorneys are working to see the restraining order lifted, given the federal government's new stance on tribes who want to grow marijuana. Whiteplume says he believes industrial hemp farming could be a culturally and environmentally appropriate form of economic development.
Now we're finally at a point where we can really exercise our right, and maybe we'll see some money as the outcome. Could be a thing that we could be an example for around the world where you could use the hemp for local cottage industry, just for the families that live on their land.
Whiteplume says he approves the federal guidelines that have been laid out for any tribes who want to grow and sell cannabis as a drug. The president of the Oglala Sioux tribe, John Yellowbird Steele, says he supports industrial hemp on Pine Ridge, but not marijuana. For National Native News, I'm Charles Michael Ray in Rapid City, South Dakota.
In January, Pope Francis announced he would bestow sainthood on Junipero Serra, a Franciscan friar who founded nearly half of California's Catholic missions. However, the announcement was met with condemnation and protest by tribal members in the state who called Serra a monster responsible for brutalizing indigenous people while stripping them of their tribal identities, cultures, and religions. Those protests were repeated again on Easter Sunday as nearly 200 demonstrators descended on the Carmel Mission in Carmel, California, where Junipero Serra is buried. For National Native News, I'm Tristan Ottone.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kiwanis Broadcast Corporation, with offices in Anchorage, Alaska. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, and the Ford Foundation.
Support by NativeGiving.org, empowering Native children and families through community giving.
All the donations made on NativeGiving.org go toward the organization you choose.
Information on successful innovations at NativeGiving.org. Support by the Association of American Indian Physicians. Colon cancer is the second leading cause of cancer death in American Indians 50 and over. For yourself, your family, and our community, get screened. Info at AmericanIndianCancer.org.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
You're listening to a Juno Afternoon here on Monday, April 6, 2015. It's about 6 minutes after the hour, and joining me now on the telephone is Maud Morse. She is an outreach specialist with the Alaska Housing Finance Corporation. Welcome, Maud.
Thank you very much for having me, Scott.
It's nice to have you on the phone. So we're going to have some classes here in Juneau about buying a house. It looks like on the 21st and 22nd.
Actually, it is going to be on April 15th and 16th. Right there over on Postal Way. It's over at the Riverbend Apartments. It's in our community center.
Okay. And what can folks expect at these classes?
It is a free 8-hour home buyer education class. And what we talk about is the pros and cons right from the very beginning, should you buy that home, to realizing that home ownership dream. We're going to talk about how to shop and select your lender, your real estate professional that could work with you.
Okay. I mean, because thinking about buying a home, it can be a pretty intimidating prospect. There's a lot to go through. So I imagine folks really appreciate a class like this.
Yeah, my motto is don't get sold, get educated. There's a lot to know when it comes to buying a home. And it's one of the hugest purchases most people are going to be making in their lifetime. So by taking a home buyer education, you really empower yourself with information to go out there and shop and compare. And, you know, the federal government has made a lot of new regulations out there about buying a home. And one of the things that they say is only you can get the best mortgage loan for yourself. So we're hoping that the information and tools we give them in our home buyer class helps them, just gets them in that comfort zone of saying, hey, what is the best loan for me?
And I suspect the class is tailored for first-time home buyers, but would it be helpful for someone who's thinking about maybe refinancing or buying a second home? Would they benefit from this class as well?
Yes, I think everybody would benefit from the class. And you're right. We do have a lot of first-time home buyers that take the class. We also have seasoned buyers that take the class and people who are about to sell their home also. And that's because the home buying market has changed quite a bit. And it helps them navigate their way through the process. And it might have changed from when they made their purchase of their first home. So we are having all kinds of walks of life in our class.
Okay. You work for the Alaska Housing Finance Corporation. Can you tell us a little bit about what you do there?
Yes. Alaska Housing Finance Corporation is a publicly owned finance corporation. So we actually purchase mortgage loans from your local lenders there. And when I talk about lenders, it's the bank or the credit union, the mortgage company. And what I do for Alaska Housing is provide consumer information and awareness. I'm one of the instructors for the home buyer class called Home Choice. It's been around for over 20 years, and I've actually been teaching it for the last 10 years. And what we do is just empower individuals on information, some of the services and products that we offer. So it just kind of helps them be a little bit more informed and hopefully save themselves some money.
Okay. So can you remind us the details of where and when it's going to be again?
All right. Well, we have a class that's scheduled for April. It's April 15th and 16th. It's over at Alaska Housing Finance Corporation's public housing division, we have apartments over there called River Bend. It's behind the post office. It's located at 2800 Postal Way. And we also have a class in May. In May, we have a class, and of course, I'm not sure exactly when it's in May, but we also have a class. Oh, actually, May 6th and 7th, same location. 6 to 10 p.m. is when our classes are. You can contact Alaska Housing at www.ahfc.us. We list all of our classes there. You can register online, or you can simply give us a phone call.
And I found you pretty easily on Facebook, too.
Oh, good. Oh, good. Please like us on Facebook.
Will do. Okay, Maude, anything else you want to add about the classes?
Well, I just want to let you know that we don't only teach classes to the general public who are interested in buying a home. We also have continuing education credits for your local real estate licensees there right in Juneau. So we're hoping to be a good neighbor and a friend, and if you guys need anything, please call us.
Sounds good. And actually, I thought of one more question. Can you give us like two highlights from this class, two pieces of information that you really like sharing with people?
Well, I will tell you this. Every time I teach the class, and what I'm hearing from most folks that have taken our class, they wish they'd done it way beforehand. And I also love empowering people with information. So helping somebody realize that home ownership dream, this class kind of helps you, puts you on the path, and then kind of figures out what the expectation of what the local lenders and investors require for you to get a home loan.
Okay. Maude Moore, she's an outreach specialist for the Alaska Housing Finance Corporation. Thank you for your time today.
Thank you very much, Scott, and I look forward to seeing folks in our home buyer class.
Sounds good. Take care.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Little boxes on the hillside, little boxes made of ticky-tacky, little boxes, little boxes, little boxes all the same. There's a green one and a pink one and a blue one and a yellow one, and they're all made out of ticky-tacky, and they all look just the same. And the people in the houses all go to the university, and they all get put in boxes, little boxes, all the same. And there's doctors and there's lawyers and business executives, and they're all made out of ticky-tacky, and they all look just the same. And they all play on the golf course and drink their martini dry, and they all have pretty children, and the children go to school, and the children go to summer camp, and then to the university, and they all get put in boxes, and they all come out the same. And the boys go into business and marry and raise a family, and they all get put in boxes, little boxes, all the same. There's a green one and a pink one and a blue one and a yellow one, and they're all made out of ticky-tacky, and they all look just the same.
And you're listening to A Juneau Afternoon here on Monday, April 6, 2015. It's about 14 minutes after the hour.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Monday. It's the 6th of April, 2015. It was on this day, 1327, the Italian poet Petrarch first saw his beloved Laura de Novis, a noblewoman living in Avignon with her husband. Petrarch was 22, she was maybe 17. They saw each other at the Holy Week service at the Church of St. Clair of Avignon. He fell instantly in love with her, and he wrote poems about her for the rest of his life. It's the birthday of the Italian painter Raphael, born Raffaello Sanzio in Urbino, Italy, 1483. He spent a few years in Florence, where he met Michelangelo and Leonardo, who was his big influence. Raphael created figures with round, serene faces that appeared sublime, mainly pictures of the Madonna. In his lifetime, he produced more than 300 paintings of the Madonna, including his famous Sistine Madonna. 1917, on this day, the United States officially entered World War I after a German U-boat sank the passenger ship Lusitania. It's the birthday of Merle Haggard, born near Bakersfield, California, 1937, the heart of the Depression. Parents had moved from Oklahoma to California to look for work. Merle Haggard grew up in Oildale, a little town of migrant workers on the outskirts of Bakersfield, lived in a boxcar the family had made into a house. His father played fiddle and guitar, and Haggard took up the instruments after his father died when the boy was 9 years old. He was a rebellious kid. He hopped freight trains, skipped school. He was a thief, was in and out of jail. In 1958, he tried to escape from a county jail, ended up in San Quentin Prison. But at the same time, he taught himself guitar by listening to records. Merle Haggard, who wrote Mama Tried, Hungry Eyes, Working Man Blues. It's the birthday of the biologist James Dewey Watson, born Chicago, 1928, who, along with Francis Crick, discovered the molecular structure of DNA, the double helix. And it's the birthday of the critic and novelist Robert Coates, New Haven, Connecticut, 1897. As a young man, went off to Paris, met Gertrude Stein, Hemingway, came back to New York, and became the art critic of the New Yorker magazine for 30 years. It was he who introduced the term abstract expressionism. Here's a poem for today by Mary Kay Stilwell, In the Morning in Morocco. There are songbirds singing and roosters crowing, dogs barking, and a pneumatic drill being used on the sidewalk below, and I wake remembering these things from Omaha, as if the sound of the sea of the gulls were from Omaha to wake, wondering that I have traveled so far to find dream and reality, and dream just touching at seams like the panels of heavy curtains at the window touching, letting in this bright light along the edges. A poem by Mary Kay Stilwell, In the Morning in Morocco, from Maps and Destinations, published by Stephen F. Austin State University Press, and used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac, supported by Progressive Insurance with its Apron Project, celebrating progress and the people who make it happen, and by Lumosity.com, personalized brain training developed by neuroscientists to challenge memory and problem-solving through online games, Lumosity.com. Produced by Joy Biles, assisted by Kathy Roach. Be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
Support comes from Heritage Coffee Roasting Company, offering coffee break service for the office, delivering fresh roasted coffees, brewing equipment, and beverage supplies to offices and businesses around Southeast. Information at heritagecoffee.com.
It's about 20 minutes after the hour. You're listening to A Juno Afternoon here on KTOO-FM and KRNN-FM on Monday, April 6, 2015. Scott Burton, your host, joining me now in the studio is volunteer coordinator Jeremy Johnson for the Community Emergency Response and Training Program. Jeremy, welcome.
Thanks, Scott.
Did I get that all right?
Yeah. Well, Community Emergency Response Team.
Okay.
But yeah.
Well, welcome. Thanks for coming to the studio today.
Thanks for having me. I'm always happy to come in and promote good community stuff. You know, I'm not necessarily a frequent voice, but every time I get the opportunity to promote such good programs like these, I definitely want to be a part of promotion for it.
Great. And you've been doing this for like 6 years now on a volunteer basis, is that right?
That's correct. My first exposure to the program was with the University of Alaska Southeast. When I was employed there, I had, my son was about one. And my community emergency response team for the campus unit started to come together. We had about 22 people at the university. And it was pretty much a paid training for the staff were working there, or there during the training on all of the different community resources that were available to do the trainings with the university resources. There was a special section where they brought basically a portable tub of fuel, and they lit it on fire, and they just let us extinguish it right there on campus. But they had one of the volunteer firefighter guys. I think Ray was volunteer firefighter, a former volunteer firefighter. He did the lecture for that class, and then the instructor for medical and that sort of stuff is the guy that's our training coordinator now. That's Mike Lopez at Bartlett. He's actually the primary contact for getting registered, mainly because he's got a more professional appeal with his hospital title than Jeremy the programmer does, right?
And that's right, you're a computer programmer by day.
Yeah. I spend most of my time problem solving programmatically.
Okay, so you have several classes, several sessions. They begin tomorrow night, it looks like. And let's get to those details in a minute. But how you got into this, I think, is really interesting. Tell us that story.
Sure. I'll start off by saying before I really got into community emergency response on a volunteer basis, I had some pretty traumatic things happen, you know, things ranging from a fire where I was not injured to car accidents. But the thing that really changed my life was the tornado. And so I grew up in Indiana, which is about 30 minutes from Indianapolis. So it's a small town called Rushville. And I was in a trailer. You know, we grew up in a trailer, which is great because I got hit by a tornado. It's so cliche. But the tornado passed by overhead, and it hadn't touched down until it got to, I think, Richmond. And the ground line winds were roughly 75, 85 miles an hour. It's like a pretty heavy squall. And we didn't have any trees.
How old were you at that time?
Freshman in high school. Okay. So 14, maybe.
Must have been horrifying.
It was pretty terrifying. I mean, but let me paint a picture real quick.
Please do.
Yeah. Sure. I had gone to sleep that night, and I'd fallen asleep with my glasses on, which at the time was something pretty significant because I was really interested in keeping my glasses. I was really trying to keep them safe. I hadn't gotten glasses until I was in seventh grade, so I'd only had them a couple of years. And I woke up in the middle of the night, and it was raining really heavy, and my trailer window had a broken mechanism for opening and closing, so we had a little wooden block holding it open for those hot summer days, and this was definitely a hot summer day. And the rain and the thunder and the lightning let me know that I need to close the window, not that there was anything dangerous going on. And so at the same time, I popped out that little thing, and I realized, I have my glasses. And so I found my glasses next to my bed, and I folded them up very nicely and neatly, and I set them on the side, the end table. And then I laid down and pulled the blankets up, and I was like, this feels good. Then the tornado went by overhead, literally within seconds of having pulled the covers up to my neck. It rolled the trailer over greater than 360 degrees, and each wall laid after the first 90 degrees. So first 90 degrees, that wall turned, then the ceiling, then the next wall, then the ground, then whatever was captured flipped away into the cornfields. But for me, I was thrown against the wall that stayed. a computer monitor, then because the orientation changed, fell on my face because now I was under it, whereas before I was parallel to it. I literally was hit in the face with a computer monitor of the CRT variety. Let's not kid ourselves.
Big.
Yeah, yeah. And then after that, I stood up in what I can only consider complete desolation. And from my perspective, because my home and all my belongings were no longer parsed and put in little cubicles or storage spaces, scattered around as quickly as possible. And I didn't see my family. I was standing there alone in a wasteland, looking around, thunder, lightning, tornado going by overhead, all this stuff. And then I hear my mom scream, and she sees me and screams my sister's name, and it was really moving for me. So I look around, I'm frantically looking for her. Then I remembered that people can have adrenaline rushes and lift heavy things, so I looked down and lifted the first thing in front of me. I was amazed I could pick it up. It was shocking. She was nowhere near that wreckage. She was very far away, closer to where her bedroom might have displaced. And luckily, she had a day bed that had a mattress that protected her. And for me, luckily, I was a kid and could take injury.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. And then, as the story goes, folks helped you out, right?
Truly, truly. The neighbors immediately were welcoming from the stance of, we just lost our home, we don't know what to do. We looked around, the house next door was available. And then the very next day, of course, we all went in and sheltered there, but the very next day, we had a collection of service workers, the police were there, some volunteers. I'm talking on the scale of some 80 to 100 volunteers all showed up. You know, I lived 3.5-4 miles outside of town in the extreme rural section. So that meant that those people had to have taken off the day of work or that they had left school or something pretty extraordinary for them to be there. They were helping us recollect what little of our lives we could pull back together. And over the next 2 to 4 weeks, people started bringing in simple things that really impacted us greatly. Toiletries, you know, the kinds of things that I thought were pretty insignificant at the time were pretty significant to my mom. So, you know, the shampoo and toilet paper and that kind of stuff was like, oh, wow, look at all this cool stuff that my mom's really going to be happy about. And then a couple of movies and a couple of books came in, and I was like, oh, look at this, yeah. You know, I wish I could remember those as well as I could remember being hit in the face. But the idea of the breadth and depth of the community involvement after a veritable cataclysm, at least it was for us, you know, that was really important to me. I mean, the local Lions Club bought us glasses. So my special glasses, I was really, you know, oh, man, I can't believe I lost my glasses. They bought me glasses. My student friends, they said, you know, you guys can come and stay with me for a few weeks. I'm beating that word to death, but luckily I'm not using it figuratively. I spent 3 weeks at my friend's house while my mom was given an 80% discount and a hotel room on a local business. So, I mean, everyone from community members, friends, we didn't have much for family there, but the family that was there was my mom's sister, who over the following months was able to secure a loan, and all of these things fell together because the community was trying to support a single mom and her kids who were displaced by truly terrible circumstances. I couldn't imagine what it would be like just having to pick up from something as awful as that.
Wow. And now you're giving back, creating an infrastructure by teaching these classes that could provide that kind of help with folks here in Juneau
if we
ever had something awful happen. So I see that you have 9 sessions, and folks can register for one or any of the sessions. And it starts tomorrow night. Can you highlight just a couple of them for us, and then we'll give the folks the information where they can see them all in detail on the web?
Sure. My favorite class is formally fire suppression. I mean, that's my favorite class by far.
Get to light stuff on fire, right?
Yeah. And you get to really see people tackle a fire for the first time, and in some cases in their lives. My first fire was on a parking lot for a truck stop, and someone lit a trash can on fire at the truck stop. So I had multiple fire extinguishers trying to put that out as a teenager again. But not many people have even had to put out a kitchen fire. You know, most people miss out that on that opportunity, I suppose. But having a pan fire that's the size of, say, a common business desk is pretty intimidating. Mm. You get to see the equivalent of a bonfire made from liquid fuel, and you get to put it out. My favorite part is when the extinguishers fail to dispense. So you see someone going up thinking that they are fighting a fire with a totally legitimate extinguisher, and it gives up some 5 seconds in. So it's producing really good push, and then suddenly it gives up. Gives people a real eye-opener to what it would be like if you had to actually step up to a kitchen flame, a big flame, and you didn't have backup. So we really stress the ideology of do not ever do anything alone. Furthermore, we're not firefighters. If you can't put it out with your two extinguishers, step back and accept the losses that you're looking at, you know, like a building fire or something. But responsibly, we teach contact 911, make sure that we've got this sort of thing in order. But if you're going from house to house after an avalanche or a flood where bridges are knocked out and the full emergency responders are just tied up with more serious stuff, and you're just trying to help out your community, if a kitchen fire breaks out, say from some fuel line or some internal structure thing that you didn't know about while you were maybe walking in to check on an elderly neighbor or a young couple that might not know what to do after an avalanche or after an earthquake or something like that, you walk in and you say, hey, I'm just here to check things out. You guys okay? And you know, that sort of community mentality is very important, especially in environments where the actual natural forces will, in fact, play against you, whether it's a tornado or an earthquake or an avalanche or the breakage of an ice dam.
Sure, sure. So where can folks go to get a detailed list of all these classes, Jeremy?
Right now, our contact is Mike Lopez, so M-L-O-P-E-Z, that's M. Lopez at bartletthospital.org. We're trying to improve the web presence so that way we have more presentable material online, but right now we don't have a web presence. Normally what we do is we notify the community via these sorts of forums and bulletin boards around town, that sort of thing. The most people do through the email, but I also promote people giving him a call at 796-8989 and let him know that you want to register. And if anything comes up, we just notify people on that have pre-registered and set up a notification platform for if something, you know, keeps it from happening or that kind of thing.
Okay. So again, 9 sessions. It looks like at the end, somewhere in early May, you have a graduation ceremony and potluck. That looks like fun, too. Are these classes, do they cost money?
Nope, it's totally free, fully sponsored by the city. I should take a moment to say that the Community Emergency Response Team is formally under the Federal Emergency Management Administration. So the coursework and all materials are formally organized by FEMA, and the normal session experience is 9 sessions for 9 dates. And what we have are the sessions broken up a little bit differently. So you'll see session 3-4 and session 5-6 combined into 1, because basically our population and our turnout requires that we kind of merge,
sure,
some of these things together.
And it looks like almost all the classes are at Bartlett.
Yes, normally we did a fire training center over at the Hegvig Center, but they've got some classes going on, conflict schedule, Bartlett Regional opened their doors to us, and we really appreciate them for that.
Well, Jeremy Johnson, thank you so much for doing this. Thank you for coming in on the show today to tell us about this. Again, if you want more information, call Mike Lopez at 796-8989 or send him an email at mlopez@bartletthospital.org. Are we missing anything, Jeremy?
No, Scott. I thank you so much for having me in today.
You're welcome. Take care.
This is Bird Note. A light April rain falls in the Anza Borrego Desert in southeast California. Cacti and wildflowers glisten with raindrops, and birds begin to sing. The sweet, jumbled notes of a house finch rise above the sound of the rain. A Buick's wren buzzes, then breaks into exuberant song. A cactus wren joins the chorus, standing atop a barrel cactus, calling gruffly. Acosta's hummingbird hovers at a cactus blossom, beating the air with thrumming wings. A mourning dove coos. Spring rains rejuvenate the desert. The soundscape featured in today's show was recorded by Gordon Hempton of QuietPlanet.com. You'll find a link to his work on birdnote.org. I'm Michael Stein.
We wrapped up the on-air portion of the spring membership campaign this Saturday. Thanks to everyone who contributed this past week and in the weeks leading up to it. And, of course, thank you goes to all of our sustaining members who are always members in good standing. For those of you we missed this week, it's not too late. Just go to ktoo.org and make your contribution there. Thanks so much.
And you're listening to a Juno Afternoon here on Monday, April 6, 2015. Scott Burton, your host. And it's about 20 minutes until the top of the hour. I've been joined in the studio by Kathy DiLorenzo. She's a professor out at the UAS School of Management. Is that correct, Kathy?
Yes, the Public Administration Program in the School of Management.
All right. Thanks for coming on the program today.
Thank you.
And Tom Chard, you are a graduate student in the same school and about to graduate. Congratulations.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Scott.
You must be floating.
Ask me that question in a month.
Oh, yeah. A few more projects. A
couple presentations, a couple projects, a couple papers.
It'll be fine. It'll be fine.
Okay, so you have an interesting new partnership with 360 North, and mm-hmm. you're going to be doing a television program on Medicaid expansion and reform. Is that right?
Yes.
Okay. Tell us a little bit, give us a little background. I think we all know what Medicaid is, but give us Medicaid 101, if you don't mind.
Well, I'd like to actually throw that question to my student, Tom Chard, since he's works and is very adept in that area. So, Tom?
So it was really exciting that the University of Alaska Southeast and the School of Management decided to put this presentation on so timely. As you're aware, Scott, there's a big discussion going on right now in the legislature and across the state around Medicaid expansion. And the decision that we have is whether or not to expand Medicaid to cover an additional 40,000 Alaskans, bring some much-needed revenue into the state, and really redesign our program through some of the reform efforts that are available. So I couldn't be more happy that the School of Management jumped into that discussion and wanted to help inform the dialogue.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And give us a little history of Medicaid here in the state, if you don't mind. So the Affordable Care Act was initiated in 2010. Is that right?
Right. So with the Affordable Care Act, initially we had the states were going to expand Medicaid, and then the insurance marketplaces were in place with subsidies to help folks afford private insurance. As you're aware, the Supreme Court later ruled that the federal government couldn't compel the states to expand Medicaid, and so made it to the option of the states. About half the states expanded Medicaid, and some of the others didn't. Governor Walker, with the new administration, has made expanding Medicaid and covering Alaskans, bringing that federal revenue into the state, a top priority. has introduced a couple of bills, HB 148 and SB 78, to that effect, and there's been a lot of discussion about expansion and reform in the legislature.
If this happens, what does it mean if these bills pass? What does that mean for Alaskans?
So if the bills pass, the expansion bills, the HB 148 and Senate Bill 78, would expand coverage to an additional 40,000 Alaskans. And here in Juneau, I actually just looked it up for this program. It's a projected about a little under 3,000 people. So 3,000 people here in Juneau eligible for access to health care where they haven't been in the past. And so we're hoping that with this newfound access that they'll be able to get health care through primary care providers instead of flooding our emergency rooms or even worse, waiting until the situation is so grave that it's actually a lot more difficult to help the individual.
And can you tell us who qualifies for Medicaid, generally speaking?
So currently, the Medicaid program in the state of Alaska has what's called categorical qualification. So if you are deemed disabled by the Social Security Administration or if you are part of the Denali Kid Care program, then you're deemed eligible for Medicaid in the state. What Medicaid expansion would do would actually add an income eligibility to the Medicaid program so that folks earning up to 138% of the federal poverty limit would be eligible for services. So here in Alaska, that equates to about somebody making a little less than $20,000 a year, or I'm sorry, a little more than $20,000 a year would be eligible for Medicaid.
Okay. Kathy, why don't you tell us a little bit about this partnership and what the program is going to look like?
Yeah, and thank you, Tom, for that very eloquent discussion on expansion there. And this is what we're trying to do. We're trying to get information out to the citizens of Alaska and help with issues in state of Alaska in terms of business, government, nonprofits, the kind of things that we train our students to understand in the program. And we're really interested in facilitating a dialogue, especially between the government and its citizens. And so the state government, the legislators, and the citizens of Alaska are all thinking about this issue and wondering what we should do and researching and trying to understand it. And there's all of these different pieces of this puzzle. And so we're just trying to bring people together, and we wanted to do it in a statewide platform that gave more access because our program is online, and we have students all over the state of Alaska and in the Yukon Territory. So we're just trying to get as much information out to across the state to people in Alaska that can help to shape how this looks in Alaska as we move on. So we wanted to go with somebody that could help us to expand statewide in a presentation like this. And so it was a perfect partnership with K2 and 360 North to be able to get it out there. We're going to have a live stream. The presentation will be from 5 p.m. to 6 p.m. tomorrow night, Tuesday, April 7th, and we will have a live stream that goes out on, I believe it's the 360 North website, and that you can get to from the K2 website. Mm-hmm. And then from there, people can watch the presentation or attend in Juneau at the 360 studio here at K2. So either attend in person or online, and we'll take questions over the phone. There'll be a number on the website, as well as you can chat or text your questions in online on the website. And we will have actually MPA students from the University of Alaska Southeast, our Master of Public Administration students who are excellent, the program there, and they will be manning those questions and then relaying them to the commissioner.
Okay, and admission costs?
Free.
Free, all right, mm-hmm. Down in the at 360. Sounds like fun. 5 to 6, any future ideas with this series or this program?
Well, I have ideas, but my dean might not want me to say out loud. I think that we are looking at topics relevant and timely in Alaska and anywhere in Alaska. And so we're anything with business, like I said, business, nonprofit, or government, and we're open to ideas from people who think that, you know, there's an important topic out there that we should be bringing together information about and bringing and facilitating that out to the citizens. So we're open to suggestions.
Okay. A multimedia free lecture on Medicaid expansion and reform at 360 Tuesday from 5 to 6. That's tomorrow. Admission is free. You can come be part of this live studio audience there. Tom, Kathy, anything we're missing? Something you'd like to add?
Just that we're joined tomorrow by our special guest host, Commissioner of Health and Social Services. So it's great that we have the person and that the program was able to pull together this resource for the whole state. So Commissioner Valerie Davidson will be joining us tomorrow from 5 to 6 p.m. in a live webcast across the state. And really great job to the University of Alaska Southeast School of Management and the Public Administration Program for pulling that all together.
Yeah, and thanks. And I'd like to just say that Valerie Commissioner Davidson was incredibly gracious about stepping right up to want to answer questions, to want to be on a live broadcast across the state with questions coming in. And she wanted to, she was very gracious about stepping right in there to get this information out of there. So we thank her too.
All right. Kathy DiLorenzo and Tom Chard, thanks for coming in today. We get it all.
Thanks, Scott. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Scott.
Walking around blind.
You're listening to a Juno Afternoon here on Monday, April 6, 2015. And it's a Juno Afternoon. It's about 10 minutes until the top of the hour. I've been joined in the studio by Mr. John Hatton. Welcome, John.
Hey, how you doing, Scott?
Nice to have you. Mm-hmm. Folks, listeners, you may know John as the guy who sells really great music during the Folk Fest, among other things, plays music and introduces music to us at the Folk Fest every year.
Yeah, I try and do as much as I can, bringing new stuff from around the country and getting new stuff every festival. So right now we've got I brought some CDs in of the Corn Potatoes, which are some hot young people from the Detroit area who've become urban homesteaders there, and they're trying to start a new scene, or working with other young folks to start a new scene down there. And they're the most, two-thirds of the band anyway is Interlochen educated, so they've got quite a bit of music competency, we shall say. And but their take and interpretation of traditional music is just outstanding.
Awesome. Let's play a cut off that in just a second. But tell us about, so we see you at Folk Fest every
year. Yes, you do.
And tell us about the rest of your year.
It starts in January and ends in November.
Uh-huh.
I try and take December off.
Okay.
And part of May. But I travel between Alaska and Alabama and coast to coast. And we do at least one or two festivals a month.
Wow.
Either week long, or which includes workshops, or actual three-day festival events.
So it almost sounds like the greatest job on the planet.
I try and make it look that way, but it's there's always logistical problems and making sure that you don't get caught in 50-mile snowstorms like we did on the way down to Tennessee this spring in the beginning of March. And having to put things off for a couple of days. But, you know, most of the time it works out really well.
Okay. What are your two favorite festivals in America?
They're all different. But I always enjoy coming to Juneau for the Alaska Folk Festival. I look forward to it every year.
Well, we love having you.
Yeah.
All right, so this cut is called Raleigh and Spencer, and these are the Corn Potato String Band. You want to play it?
Sure.
All right, let's do it. right, so that's Raleigh and Spencer by the Corn Potato String Band. This is just one example of the music that you will have available at the Folk Fest.
Yes, yes.
And who are other another couple highlights?
Well, there's Howard Raines and Tricia Spencer's new recordings of old Texas fiddle music, which is not to be confused with Western swing or contest-style fiddle music. And it's amazing stuff that Howard's been collecting for years and reinterpreting and trying to emulate as much as he can. And now we have the opportunity of hearing it with twin fiddles.
Okay, very cool. And you also sell local music as well. And you
yes.
sold some of our CDs for us, the Bluegrass Band, the Great Alaska Bluegrass
right.
Band,
yeah, yeah.
a couple of years ago. Thank
yeah.
you for doing that.
Sure, you're very welcome. The artists that come that will be, not the guest artists, but all the other artists that come throughout the festival, the ones that have the 15 minutes of fame, will all be dropping their products off, if they remember to do that, if they have anything to sell. And I'll be taking care of that for them and make sure that we give them as much exposure as we can.
Okay. So, excellent. And Foghorn is coming
Foghorn
as well,
will
right?
be at the Alaskan on Saturday night. And we're very lucky to have them in town.
Yeah.
As a matter of fact, they'll be doing one of the dances, too. I think that's on Friday night.
Okay.
So they'll be there. We'll get to see them twice, once at the festival and then once in a very social venue, as we like to say.
I love that such a big band like Foghorn is just coming to our festival just to be here.
Yeah.
Because it's such a cool festival.
Well, they like it, too.
Yeah. Well, we love having them as well. All right, John Hatton, you'll be out there tonight.
I will be.
You're probably already set up over there.
Oh, no. I'll be over around 5:30 setting up again. And we have to set up and break down every night because that's just the way the logistics work. So that's part of the glamour that's not so glamorous is moving things all the time.
Okay. Well, nice to see you. Thanks for coming in and sharing.
Gotcha.
And we're going to go out with the Corn Potato String Band again. What's this next track we have?
It's, oh boy.
Mansovia?
Mansovia, yes.
Okay. We'll see you down at the festival.
You betcha.
Tonight, cloudy, chance of rain was around 39. Light winds becoming southeast 10 miles per hour late. And Tuesday, rain likely, highs around 46, southeast wind 10 to 15 miles per hour. Wednesday, rain, highs around 44, southeast wind 10 to 15 miles per hour. And Thursday, rain, highs around 43. Thanks for tuning in to a Juno afternoon.
Satellite system.